Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
We were talking to Katrina Perry earlier, and I think a lot of us did get sucked into the political drama in the US this week, and I think with drama more than politics, maybe. It started, obviously, feels so long ago now, with an assassination attempt this time last week. Then the Republican convention was like wild. Variously compared to a religious revival or the Colosseum in ancient Rome with Trump as emperor. It featured everyone from Kid Rock to Hulk Hogan. Melania even turned up briefly. And then, of course, the contrast with Joe Biden. And I think watching it all, we did realise more clearly maybe than before that facts don't play a huge part in a lot of this, that it's about telling a story. And so I'm joined now by Dr. Harvey O'Brien. And Harvey is head of film at the UCD School of English Drama and Film. Welcome, Harvey.
Thank you, Brendan.
So we're going to have a look at this story Trump and the Republicans are telling and how they're doing it. So first off, are we hardwired to respond to particular stories with a particular structure, particular characters?
Stories are how we help to make sense of the world. The world is an incredibly complex place featuring so many dimensions, so many elements that we just don't understand, that we always find a way to simplify it through story. We're taught this from childhood. We're taught literally fairy stories. Once upon a time, happily ever after, and the moral of the story is. So, you know, you're told when you're living in a village in medieval Europe that the woods are dangerous. So you make up a story about a little girl who goes into the woods and meets a big bad wolf. We're hardwired to understand things in terms of simple metaphors. Most religions are based around, again, compelling stories that explain how things came to be by the intervention of higher powers, bigger things than us that we can't understand, but we can understand in terms of simple things. Good guys, bad guys, journeys, the things you do, the things you don't do. So yeah, we have a predisposition to accept story. But story can be very dangerous because in oversimplifying the complexity of the world, we can miss that complexity and the necessity to have things like, you know, a dialectic or looking at things from different perspectives. Instead, it's just, well, I know what the story is. This is true. Everyone else is wrong.
Okay. And it's right there. I think Fintan O'Toole once referred to truthiness, like that a story can feel true to us in a way that complex facts are just too much.
Exactly. Well, I mean, the entire rhetoric of Trump since, you know, 2016 and thereabouts has been around exactly that. Yeah. When Kellyanne Conway came out with alternative facts, I mean, that just scared everybody. The idea that you can't have verifiable evidence of anything because, well, I have something that says exactly the opposite. And it's not a debate. It's not a dialogue. It's not a dialectic. It's no, you're wrong and I'm right.
So like Trump going into the convention this week then, had a kind of a perfect story to tell, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, again, the presidential kind of representation in film has a very long history, and hopefully we'll talk a little bit about that in a second. But it is always about building a story around yourself. And the story that, you know, Trump has been telling is the same one that he's been telling for years and years and years, that he's an extremely successful businessman who's outside of the domain of politics and yet running for the highest political office in the United States, which is a paradox. And that story of success and strength and resilience is an emotional story. And that emotional story makes sense to people because it's comforting. It's one that says, well, if only I could be like him, which is actually kind of terrifying if you think about it. But that strength that he's exhibiting and demonstrating and sort of overcoming the odds makes us think of your classic hero who has to overcome all of these obstacles in order to attain the goal. But that's not what this actual narrative is. This is, you know, ironically enough, by definition, you have two political candidates who are running against one another, each of them telling the same story, that I'm overcoming the difficulties that I need to overcome in order to be the best person to represent you, the people. The power is technically coming from the voters who then say, we give you the authority as the highest executive office in the land to make decisions that will affect our lives. One of the interesting things about the rhetoric of politics is we see in the conventions, the Democratic convention is coming up, the Republican convention has just gone by. They always introduce their candidate as the next president of the United States. By definition, one of them is wrong. It's not a fact. It's just a statement. And that statement then is meant to be compelling evidence that this is the right story that you're going to hear. And yet, by definition, the two stories say exactly the opposite thing. This person is president. This person is president.
And then I had a near-death experience. God literally reach down and save you and everything. And
the rhetoric of the supernatural.
That's hard to beat as a story.
Yeah, it's literally Deus Ex Machina. I mean, so that the forces, the intractable, powerful forces of the beyond controlled my destiny. This is how the classic stories of heroes worked in Greek mythology. Again, the hero would go on a journey to be tested in order to prove that they were worthy and that their people were worthy. And very often they would require the intervention of a god who was something beyond them in order to help them to overcome a particular monster that they didn't understand. And then that patron god essentially became kind of the thing that was being venerated by the actions of the heroes. And Christian mythology worked the same way. I mean, classic crusaders obviously believed they were doing what they were doing in the name of God. It sanctified their actions, even though from an historical standpoint, by definition, those were acts of genocide.
And then in terms of how they tell the story, then I have some clips here because I went down this rabbit hole of, and like not watching long stretches of television, just these clips that were flying around and stuff. But the near-death experience, they then kind of turned it into a weird sort of showbiz. So this is Donald Trump Jr. speaking to a reporter at the convention about the first phone call he had with his father after the shooting. And he sounds like an actor telling an anecdote on a chat show.
You know, we're just on speakerphone, you know, talking to him. He's just, you know, very calm, collected. It got to the point where it was like almost, he sort of needed that icebreaker. So me, I'm usually the inappropriate guy. So I was like, so, you know.
How's the hair? How's the hair? He goes, the hair's fine, but it's a little bloody. There's a little blood in the hair, but the hair's fine.
So, you know, we had a little moment of, you know, of levity there.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a somber moment.
You remember then, or it was a somber moment.
It was a somber moment, yeah.
What story is Biden telling, or what character is he playing at this stage, or has he lost control of any story?
Ironically, he's telling the same story that Trump is, that he's strong and that he's capable and that he's the best person for the job. And that is ultimately the story that every politician tells. At the moment, his story is not being believed. And not even by people from within his own party. But again, that story is, he's positioned also as a senior figure. And there's a real interesting paradox in that from the point of view that the Trump campaign, you know, positions Biden as senior and therefore incapable, 3 years older than Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. But then Biden is positioned as senior within his own party on the point of view that his experience and his kind of paternalism is actually steadying by comparison with the chaos of someone acting like a child, which is the image being portrayed of Donald Trump. So again, these are binary opposites in story terms, the child and the adult, and how we kind of perceive that, well, the adults in the room need to make the decision. Okay. And that's the story the Biden campaign is putting forward.
And then, Trump is a classic villain, according to the Biden story then. Is he like the child?
Well, he's an out-of-control chaos. child, from that point of view. And again, that's how these things work. It's like I always say when you look at history, nobody ever sat down and twirled their moustache and said, I shall be a villain today. Everybody tells the story from their point of view, from their perspective, and they see themselves as the protagonist of their own story. They see themselves as the hero of their own story. This is how stories function. We don't actually, you know, really want to think of ourselves as being the bad guy. And yet narrative always presents us with a bad guy, an antagonist. How it works is that there's a situation of stasis, of the status quo, of a world that makes some sort of sense, that's interrupted by some kind of external force or a nemesis. And then a hero has to rise to rebalance it so that that nemesis is vanquished and the world makes sense again. Now, what does that sound like? I mean, that is exactly the MAGA narrative, make America great again. Yeah. But from the point of view of political rhetoric, think about it. Is Biden arguing that America shouldn't be great again? No, I mean, it's the same story they're all telling, but they're telling it from different points of view. And it's the incapacity to find a space in the middle to navigate and negotiate and discuss ideas. I mean, there's Don Jr. They weren't discussing economics, you know, they weren't discussing poverty in America. They're discussing just the drama, the high drama, because that simplifies what is complicated.
Yeah, and then the Republican convention, there was an aspect of it that was almost Shakespearean as well, because Trump turned up every night. And a lot of what we saw was the people who had been critics of him, doubters, almost like their heads being paraded before the king, wasn't it? They all stood up and kind of basically kissed the ring, as the phrase goes.
Absolutely. And that's classic political theatre. And that there's nothing new in that. We've been seeing that for a very long time. And again, classic drama was built around the doings of kings and princes, those who are greater and more powerful than us, the activities in the court. And the activity of kind of coronation, which was mentioned earlier on, that you know, kind of the handing of the torch and the paying of obeisance is part of a ritual that demonstrates to the voter, so to speak, the ordinary people, that all of those in power defer to this person who is in the most authority in the situation. But the political theatre of the Republican rally, and indeed the Democratic rally when it comes, that's been the same all throughout the 20th century. And you go back to the early 1930s and to the rallies that took place in Germany at that time. It was the same political theatre with the same message: unity. That we are all of one mind. Unity is not consensus. It doesn't necessarily mean we agree. It means we just decide we're all of one voice. And to use like a Star Trek reference, that makes you the Borg. You know, you don't have actually individual personality. You surrender your will to the represented elected official. So that's inherently dangerous when you think of that as a reality as opposed to a story. It's one thing to fantasize about having superpowers, having Iron Man come and rescue us, but we don't have superpowers. We're just people. And the power people have is in the democratic process and in voting. And the story that's being told is that these are the superheroes that we should just trust to do our job for us.
There was a big push last week as well to soften Trump's image, and particularly, I guess, the idea of the family man is a powerful trope as well in a story, isn't it? Let's just have a listen to this. They wheeled out Trump's 17-year-old granddaughter, Kai, to speak at the convention.
To me, he's just a normal grandpa. He gives us candy and soda when our parents aren't looking. He always wants to know how we're doing in school. When I made the high honor roll, he printed it out to show his friends how proud he was of me. And he calls me during the middle of the school day to ask how my golf game is going and tells me all about his. But then I have to remind him that I'm in school and I'll have to call him back later. The media makes my grandpa seem like a different person, but I know him for who he is. He's very caring and loving. He truly wants the best for this country, and he will fight every single day to make America great again.
Okay,
Thank you very much. That is
Donald Trump's 17-year-old granddaughter, Kai. So is this an attempt to obviously there's a story out there about Trump exemplified maybe in grabbing by the plea.
Yeah, oh,
and
yeah.
This is an alternative narrative here of some kind of like softy grandfather.
Again, it's what we were talking about earlier about facts, evidence, information, etc. And I mean, that's his granddaughter, but his niece wrote a book, which I read.
Yes.
And that tells a very different story of her uncle. So again, it's another story and it's another perspective. And the fact is, as Citizen Kane, you know, kind of told us, you know, that no one word can explain a man's life. No one specific thing actually tells you who somebody is. That the different dimensions that a person has will appear at different contexts and at different points in their lives. And sure, she can tell that story. That may be her experience of her. But there are dozens and dozens of other stories, some of which are in courts of law, that tell different stories. So the purpose is to eliminate those that don't tell the master narrative that you want to tell, the overarching great man theory of history that, you know, here is destiny manifest, which is often associated with the American president, is not being kind of damaged by counter evidence because it doesn't matter. I read a piece just this morning by Aoife Gallagher about conspiracy. And of course, the point is the thing that makes a conspiracy theory is that there isn't actually any evidence and that you're driven by emotion and that these stories are all emotional stories designed to appeal and pull the heartstrings so that you stop thinking about counter evidence. You stop thinking about argument. You stop thinking about context and meaning. And instead you just say, once upon a time, there rose a great hero and he came to power and everybody lived happily ever after.
So it's bypassing the cognitive side of things and getting 100%. Straight to the gut. And you see, the right of centre tend to be very good at that. And you'd wonder if the left need to do a bit more of it rather than... But listen, I want to ask you about something else, because even before Hulk Hogan appeared, I think people felt there was an element of the aesthetics and the storylines of that, you know, WWE wrestling, that kind of showbiz wrestling about all this. And then, of course, you remember Hulk Hogan, Donald Trump, both reality TV stars as well.
Yeah.
Is that feeding into all this as well?
100%. Reality television really has been the scourge of the human mind since the 1990s, because people forget that reality television is actually game show first and documentary at very distant second. And it's a format of play, and it's a format of the artificial, and it's a format of, you know, tests and contests, which are fundamentally just like a game show. And Trump rose to power because of The Apprentice. His business career had already failed from that point of view historically when he came on The Apprentice. Otherwise, why would he be on The Apprentice? So The Apprentice is a game show, and he was a game show host. But it put him up as the successful businessman that was giving advice to, you know, people that were coming in. And reality television creates a false narrative that there is a truth behind it, where there actually isn't. The only truth is that it exists as a game show. The same with WWE. I mean, it's professional wrestling. Professional wrestling is built around narrative conceits. You have the babyface and the heels, as they're called. The babyface being the good guy, the heel is the bad guy. Remember, Donald Trump actually took part in a WWE fight with Vince McMahon, who is his friend, called the Battle of the Billionaires. And that was just this completely ridiculous, over-the-top spectacle that was provided for sports entertainment. Again, think about it. There's a difference between sports and sports entertainment. There's a difference between reality television and reality. And when we forget that choreography is an emotional story and take it as a truth, we leave ourselves open to be susceptible to propaganda becoming our reality.
Okay, now, J.D. Vance, who actually came to prominence as a storyteller with his memoir, Hillbilly Elegy, and like a lot of people, I bet you read it at the time and thought that he has some points here, like about poverty can mean growing up in chaos and everything, and about one good adult and everything. You look back on it now and you wonder, obviously. So how does he fit into the story here?
Again, there's already a counter-narrative. I was just reading the other day, somebody from Appalachia saying, I'm from Appalachia, and J.D. Vance serves nobody but themselves. You know what I mean?
This is Barbara King's
story. Yeah, exactly. Think, yeah. So, you know, there's always a different story. What's so upsetting in a sense about the contemporary mindset is that incapacity to try and look at things from a contextual point of view. Look at it from multiple point of views. Don't accept any one narrative as a dominant overarching narrative that explains everything, but instead try to understand that, okay, he's bringing that story to the table and that's fine. But, you know, that experience that he has, that he's representing, isn't necessarily representative of everybody's story. Everybody wants to feel they have the same qualities as the hero in a narrative. Mm. That's the whole point. And those qualities are selected to be the best of the individuals involved, so that their overcoming of the obstacles ennobles humanity on the whole. But it's like you might say about, you know, again, a superhero, as I said earlier on, you don't have those superpowers. Or a sports person who engages in sport on an individual level. We feel good when there is success for someone, for example, who plays golf. Mm-hmm. But you're not playing golf with them. You know, you're not accepting the prize money. It is their triumph at the end of the day. So we need to be able to separate ourselves psychologically.
People, in fairness, I think people feel Shane Lowry's triumph is
all
of our triumph.
But that's the point. And it's the same thing. And listen,
we could be him in a way.
The golf story is there as well. I mean, they keep using golf as a metaphor, and you just think, well, maybe they should be playing golf and let somebody else run for office.
Well, unfortunately, I think he did spend a good, I gather, a year net of his presidency was actually spent on the golf course. Now, you mentioned earlier, you've done a lot of research on how the US president is portrayed in movies.
Yeah.
Has all this, the role of the president, been informed by Hollywood, yes?
To a degree, yes, because, of course, since, you know, Kennedy rose to power in the 60s, the image of the president as being clean and telegenic and suitable for the media age has been something that's been with us. And Trump very much feeds into that. But actually, it's really quite interesting because the history of the cinema itself is a history of representation of figures of political power. And the earliest American president to be represented on film was McKinley, who was, of course, assassinated. And so the early films were of the assassination of McKinley, these dramatic dramatizations. Around the same time in Russia, the earliest films that were being made there, you weren't permitted to film or talk about the Tsar. It was a bit like a kind of Mohammeda type thing. You couldn't represent him. They were above representation. They were a saintly figure. They were a godlike figure that you couldn't represent. So American cinema would seem to be a little bit more democratic in saying, well, we can look at the president. And in fact, not that long after, in 1909, you got a film called The Teddy Bears, which dealt with President Teddy Roosevelt, who famously went on a hunting trip and refused to shoot a baby bear. And the nickname Teddy Bear became associated then with the Steiff Bears because it represented the baby bear that he didn't shoot. There was a film made called The Teddy Bears, which was basically Goldilocks and the Three Bears. But at the end, Teddy Roosevelt shows up and he shoots the mother, shoots the father, but doesn't shoot the baby. Now, you'd have no idea what that was about unless you knew the politics of the time and were able to take that. Then you get into films like Young Mr. Lincoln, which present Lincoln in this kind of hagiographic kind of format. But one of my favourites is in Yankee Doodle Dandy, which is 1942, with Jimmy Cagney playing George S. Cohan. And in 1937, George S. Cohan had done a satirical Broadway show called I'd Rather Be Right Than Be President, in which he made fun of FDR. And at the time then, he spoke to FDR, and the film portrays the whole thing as he's being summoned to the White House, and you think, oh God, he's going to be reprimanded. Actually, he's being praised for the song Over There, which was used as such a morale raiser. And the film was made in 42, even though the events were happening in the 30s. And there's this great scene where FDR is portrayed in the film from behind. You don't see him. Again, there's this godlike aura to him. Yeah. And the George M. Cohan character, Jimmy Cagney, is sitting there and he's going, isn't this great? Two Americans sitting here talking things out. There's this sense of equality as well as the mystical at the same time, which is at the heart of American democracy.
And then bring us up to date. Air Force One, we're going to play a little clip of the trailer of that now. This is 1997.
Yeah, well, you're jumping.
This is then a new kind of way.
Oh,
of,
totally.
A new way of
you're
presenting
jumping there, and again, it's an important shift. You're jumping there from the pre-war period through the 1960s, through the assassination of Kennedy, through Nixon, through the malaise around that, all the president's men, to then in the 1990s, this bizarre new vision of the American president as an action hero, which would have been inconceivable in the past. So yeah, in Air Force One, Harrison Ford plays a Gulf War veteran, I think it is, or maybe he's a Vietnam veteran, I can't remember which, who is the president of the United States, and he's on board Air Force One, which is then hijacked by Russia. Terrorists led by Gary Oldman. And it becomes Die Hard with the American president, which, again, there's an inherent absurdity to it, but the film plays it completely straight. It's directed by Wolfgang Petersen, who, of course, did Das Boot and various other terrific movies. In the Line of Fire, another film about assassinations.
But somewhere in the back of our folk memory, it's reframing what the president can be.
As an action hero.
Let's have a listen to a clip from the trailer of Air Force One.
Air Force One has been hijacked.
Sir, your parachute.
I'm not leaving without my family.
You know who I am?
I'm the President of the United States.
Jim isn't making this decision as a president. He's making it as a husband and a father.
Let's not forget this president is a Medal of Honor winner. He knows how to fight.
We cannot give in to their demands. We've got a job to do.
It makes me so proud, Mr. President, that you stuck with us.
He's not making his decisions as a president, as a husband and a father.
Yeah.
Okay, what I want to do now is I want to compare and contrast that. Now, look, in a way, we thought a lot about playing this, but I don't think it's going to like sway anyone in this country. This is a clip from an ad Trump put out during the week, but this is basically also a movie trailer.
Trump's left the building.
Over. We can now project the winner of the presidential race. Donald Trump wins the presidency.
What started off as unlikely, impossible, is now reality.
They're not coming after me, they're coming after you, and I just happen to be standing in their way, and I will never be moving. On November 5th, 2024, justice will be done. We will take back our country, and we will make America great again. When I'm reelected, I will totally obliterate the deep state.
As long as we have pride in our beliefs, courage in our convictions, and faith in our God, then we will not fail.
Like, I say it wouldn't sway anyone, but like, it's very effective stuff.
I know,
isn't it?
But
and it is basically done in the style of a movie trailer.
Well, it totally is, even down to the helicopter sound and everything. But yeah, again, I teach documentary in UCD. It's one of the things that I do there. And a film I show every year, which is not without, you know, in significant context needed, is Triumph of the Will. And Triumph of the Will is political theatre, which is exactly the same, the political theatre as now, this idea of unity. And a choreographing a single vision and choreographing emotional language. And what I always say to students is the first time I ever saw the film, I don't speak German. I had no idea what they were saying. The words meant nothing to me, but I understood what I was seeing. I understood how the images were communicating to me, the image of unity, the image of leadership. And that image is still being set forward, not exclusively by Trump. It is the language of politics. It is the language of spin. It is the language of saying everything is great, even when it isn't. We all know that internet meme with the dog sitting in the burning room saying, this is fine. There is that quality to it, that we are comforted by the idea that someone bigger and more powerful than us will sort it out, and that they're just like us deep down. The reality is they're not. The reality is that the world is incredibly complex and involves much more difficult decisions than are possible in a simple story.
Okay. Just before you go, there's still a lot of talk about the photo last week after Trump was shot. I mean, they didn't choreograph that. They couldn't have. But it turned out to be this extraordinary, iconic image. And I think a lot of people feel that moment changed everything.
Yeah, it is an amazing shot. And it immediately put me in mind of the photograph of Iwo Jima, which was itself staged. Now, let me contextualise that very carefully.
The soldiers
holding the flag, raising the flag over Iwo Jima. There's a very important piece of context when I say the word staged. I'm not saying it didn't happen. The flag was raised in Iwo Jima after the Americans took that island during the Second World War. And the flag was raised as a marker to say it was American territory. But the original flag was smaller. It was a military flag. It was a kind of plastic flag that was put up. And Joe Rosenthal was there as a war photographer. And he took photographs of that, which do exist. But he realized that there was a much better photograph if they could get a bigger flag. So he asked them to go and get a bigger flag and raise it again. This time he was ready. He was in the right position to do it. And he took that brilliant photograph that's so powerful to us. Being in the right place at the right time has been part of the history of photography and capturing the right image. But like so often, those images tie into certain traditions and representation, certain sacred images, like Dorothea Lange's famous photograph of the migrant mother, which reminds us of images of, you know, the Pieta or something like that. There's this kind of, there's a visual memory that speaks to us. And so the image communicates those images of power, unity, strength. But that's still just an image. It requires questioning. It requires analysis in order to put it in context.
I know, but you know what? All I'm hearing here is our poor rational brains have no hope against all this powerful subconscious stuff. Dr. Harvey O'Brien, Head of Film at the UCD School of English Drama and Film. That was fascinating. Thank you.